In Session with Dr. Fadid Holakwi.
Good evening. Welcome to In Session. I'm your host, Dr. Fadid Holakwi, and I'll be with you for the next hour here on Radio Hamra. Studio number to call in, 310-441-0555. You can follow me on Twitter or Instagram or like my page on Facebook to get updates on the show or suggest topics or books for the program. And the shows are uploaded at the end of each week to my SoundCloud page and podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Let's get to the books of the week. The book of the week for this week that I'll talk about on next Monday's show is Presence by Ben Alderson Day. Presence, the strange science and true stories of the unseen other. And even the cover itself looks almost like what you'd imagine a ghost story, or it's like it seems like a sheet moving, which could be like a presence of a ghost or spirit of some sorts. But from what I gather, Dr. Alderson Day in this book is talking about experiences that people have, not that there is this paranormal or supernatural experience of seeing ghosts or actually ghosts being real, but the experiences we have and what this might mean, or how we can understand it in the context of the invisible other that is with us, or how we might carry others. That's some of what I gathered just from the very brief pages or descriptions I read about the book. I've thought about this myself and talked about it on the show, that at times when people think they are being visited by a ghost, or they feel that a loved one is present with them, that they're in the room with them, their spirit is with them, that it's triggered by what I call an emotional signature. So how you feel or felt around that person gets triggered in some way, whether it's unconsciously or through a memory or some association, and then you really feel again what it was like to be around them. So you do feel them, but it doesn't mean they are actually there. So we'll see what this book, how it relates to those themes. Looking forward to reading and sharing it with you next week. The book of the week from last week that I will talk about tonight is The Courage to be Happy. Discover the Power of Positive Psychology and Choose Happiness Every Day by Ichiro Kishimi and Fumitaki Koga. Actually, that subtitle, Discover the Power of Positive Psychology and Choose Happiness Every Day, for me doesn't quite match the book itself, although choosing happiness is there. But this focus, or you know, power of positive psychology, I think brings up a lot of what we see. And that's even when I announced the book last week, I felt something in the subtitle that didn't quite sit right with me. And still, after reading the book, that doesn't seem to me the best description of the book. But nonetheless, this book is, in a way, a follow-up of a book that was written by the same two authors, Ichiro Kishimi and Fumitaki Koga, called The Courage to be Disliked. And I mentioned this last week, that of all the books I've read in these 6+ years, over 300 titles, that was and still is my favorite title, The Courage to be Disliked, because I think that's so powerful in those five words, that living a good life will necessitate that we have this courage to be disliked. Doesn't mean you want to be disliked. That's actually something people might do intentionally, let's say do things that people don't like or get attention in that way, which actually is brought up in this book. That's not what I see there. And the courage to be disliked means that if we're living true to ourselves and being authentic, being real in each moment to moment, we have to risk being disliked. And if we're afraid to be disliked or try to avoid being disliked, we can't live a genuine life. So I really liked that title, and I also really enjoyed that book. And this book is a follow-up to that, and has a very similar format to that book, which was that it's a youth and a philosopher, and the book is a dialogue of the youth and the philosopher in that book, where the philosopher is introducing the youth to Adlerian psychology, the psychology of Alfred Adler, who was, I believe, a student of Freud, but deviated from some of his ideas, and he developed a school of psychology called individual psychology. And so in that book, he's sharing with them different insights, and they're having this back and forth discussion. And so here we find that the youth has learned those lessons and now wants to go out in the world and apply them, and he quits his job as working in the university library and becomes a teacher. But now he's coming back to the philosopher to basically confront him and say, I tried those ideas that you taught me about, and they're all nonsense. They're ideals, and they might sound good in words, but they don't work in the real world, because he shares his experience as a teacher that these things didn't work with his students, trying to, for example, not use praise and not punish, and different ideals and ideas that he learned from the philosopher about Alfred Adler's thoughts and different concepts that he put forth. So he comes forward to the philosopher essentially to confront him and to challenge him and to show him that the ideas he shared with him are nonsense and not worth very much. Spoiler alert, and maybe not too much of a surprise, they have this long conversation that goes from an evening all the way until sunrise. And by the end, the youth is convinced that, oh, actually, these ideas are quite good and has a deeper understanding of them. But it's not really, you know, that itself is not the main issue there. Through this conversation, exploring these different ideas of Alfred Adler and these key concepts and going deeper and adding new ones to what was presented in the first book. And so even this back and forth, and sometimes, you know, it's like the youth is upset and it's sometimes hard to believe the way he responds, but, you know, it's kind of like a story that they're telling. But nonetheless, they go through some different concepts, and I really found the book to be fascinating. I enjoyed The Courage to be Disliked, but I also enjoyed this one. It went deeper and made me appreciate Alfred Adler's ideas even more, and I'll get into some of the major themes that came up. There's so many throughout the book. Highly recommend it. You can read them separately or just one of them. I'd recommend reading both The Courage to be Disliked and The Courage to be Happy. And if you do so, probably do it in that order. But I do recommend both very much. Two books that I strongly recommend. So The Courage to be Happy. The book again starts with this confrontation of the youth coming back to the philosopher upset, and they get into some things. And one key issue that came up early on, and for me this was very powerful, because obviously as a therapist, people are coming to me and with their concerns, issues, whatever it is they want to work on. And at some point the philosopher shared this concept that we can think of the psyche as being like a triangular column. I'm not sure why I was explained that way, but a triangular column, because the way that it can be presented, you might only see two sides out of the three at a given time. And he was saying that most people tend to only see two sides, which are, in quotes, that bad person and poor me. And so most of our complaints, and also most of where we tend to find ourselves, and I would say most of what people come to therapy with, and often, unfortunately, if the therapist is not careful, they might stay there, is either that bad person, or really people, my parents, this partner, whoever it is, and then related to that or similarly, and poor me. So I'm the victim of all this, and I'm the victim of that bad person there, or it could be some combination of those two things. And I did have to recognize that at times therapy, even I've done, can get stuck in this place, that it's still about how bad that person was and about how poor I am, or how you know, pitiful my experience has been. Poor me, the victim of all of this. But you know, a big theme in this book, a concept that keeps coming up in Adlerian thought, is self-reliance. That each one of us is responsible to be self-reliant, and also when we interact with others, even if it's our children or as an educator, which this youth is, as a teacher, our focus should be on self-reliance. And bringing up self-reliance. And we have to be careful not to breed dependence on us as parents, on us as educators, that we show respect to our children or the children we're teaching or whoever it is that we're interacting with, and try to encourage them to be self-reliant. But if we stay in that bad person and poor me, we're not focusing on self-reliance and ourselves, we're focusing on others and our own victimhood. But the third side of this triangular column, which is the one we want to focus on, and which in Adlerian therapy you're encouraging your clients to do, and he says in general in this book it's coming up to encourage people to see things this way and ourselves, is this third part of the column, which is, what should I do from now on? What should I do from now on? And so, at least as was presented in this book, Adlerian Psychology, I saw some other articles and things saying, I'm sure if it's more complex than what would be brought up in one book on a whole school of psychology, but it's very now focused and going forward focused. So it's not staying in the past and focusing on that. And that was one part that I slightly disagreed with the way it was presented, as if our past has almost no impact on our present. It wasn't so much that, I wouldn't say it was that black and white or that stark, but it had that sense. And that to me was maybe a bit too extreme. I understand the empowering notion to say that you are in control. What should I do from now on in my own life? And the past has no impact. But to say it has no impact, I think, would not make sense. I do agree with the themes that came up related to this topic, that sometimes we choose to stay stuck in the past or choose to say, well, it's my trauma or this that I went through or this relationship I had or my parents that makes me this way and I'm stuck this way. I definitely think that there is a big tendency for us to do that. We can say staying in a comfort zone or staying stuck because it's easier than facing the alternative. But to say it has almost no impact, I couldn't fully get behind that. However, I really do value this notion that rather than and making sure we don't stay stuck in that bad person or poor me ourselves and also whoever it is we're interacting with, but come to this place of, okay, what should I do from now on? These things have happened. There maybe was, that bad person, someone might have hurt you, or maybe it was poor me, I went through something difficult and that hurt. But now what should I do? What can I do going forward? And so I think that's a very empowering type of a mindset to have and one to make sure we focus on and keep our own focus on. And again, this comes back to that theme of self-reliance that I mentioned. It's throughout the book. I'm self-reliant. If it's that bad person, well, then I have to hope they stop doing that thing if they're still doing it. And if it's poor me, I'm powerless to do anything about it. I've been too hurt. I'm too weak to do anything about it. But when we go into self-reliance, we can find that we are empowered to do something about it. What should I do from now on? So I really liked that. And so what I'll do is I want to continue on this book. There are so many kernels of wisdom within it. And so I want to get to a few other themes that came up throughout the book. So after the break, I'll continue the discussion on the book, The Courage to Be Happy, by Ichiro Kashimi and Fumitaki Koga. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Continuing the discussion on the book, The Courage to Be Happy, by Ichiro Kashimi and Fumitaki Koga. So getting into a few other themes that came up. There are so many throughout the book, but a few that stood out to me. So in childhood, actually Adler was known for, when we hear people say inferiority complex, that was a concept he came up with, and he shares how in the book it comes up that children, because as humans our minds develop faster than our bodies, we become aware of our own inferiority, that I am this little person who can't do much, the people around me are stronger than me, the people around me are smarter than me, the people around me can do things I can't do, they can reach things I can't reach, for example, that was in the book. And so we feel this inferiority, and there's a whole process that we have to go through to resolve this. And people often have a hard time resolving this, and often the parents have a hard time in aiding the children in seeking this, as I was mentioning, self-reliance and recognition of their own value, and something I'll get to later about approval. But they share in the book this concept of a child choosing a lifestyle for being loved from a very young age. And I thought that was really good. So this idea that an attitude toward life, which also then relates to this lifestyle for being loved. So from a young age, children learn. And sometimes I think when we say learned, it makes it seem like it's such a conscious decision. But I think it's usually more unconscious than conscious. But they learn, how is it that I can make sure I am loved? Or that I have a sense of belonging, because they talk about how humans need one another And with isolation, we die. So we have this desire and need to be with others. And there's always going to be a fear of being isolated. And so we want to make sure we're not forgotten, that somehow we are being loved and we can't, we won't have to face not experiencing that love. And so we choose an attitude towards that, or choose a lifestyle for being loved. And so they share a few examples, but two very basic ones, almost caricatures, are the bad child and the good child. And so the good child might obey their parents because they want to always be the one that's good and get that attention. And you see this where you can tell they're so attached to this being good that it's so important for them. I never do anything wrong, and because of that, my parents love me and will always love me, and I won't be isolated or alone. But conversely, the bad child also, we might think, well, why would someone want to be bad to ensure that they get loved? But it's a way that they still stand out and they still will get attention. Sometimes you might think you're not able to get attention by being good. You maybe can get it by being bad. So this is what they mean by this lifestyle for being loved, figuring out how is it that I can make sure I continue to get love and will not be isolated. And I really resonated with this because you see this when you talk to people in general, but also in therapy, where you get to explore them and their psyche more deeply along with them, this sense that there's so much that they are doing that fits some narrative of what they think makes them good, that I have to be the good one or the bad one, or it could be obviously more complex than that, but what's my way of standing out? And it's an interesting thing that, you know, they talk about belonging, because we all want to belong and feel like we're part of the group, or we're not left out of the group. But often we think that the only way to do that is to stand out in some way, which is also a way of isolating yourself or removing yourself from the group. So we think we have to be exceptional in some way, that people don't forget me. So, you know, we want to be that special person, that special me, that we are never to be forgotten. And actually reminded me of my father often will talk about this, and I don't know how much Adler's affected him. I wanted to talk about him, or, you know, his thinking on some of these things, but about being normal, and how if you tell someone they're normal, it's actually considered quite an insult. And in the book, the philosopher tells the youth about being normal and that he doesn't have exceptional qualities, and the youth is offended and gets upset. And it's one of the many moments where the youth gets very upset with the philosopher. And but it does make sense that we recognize our own normalness, or being average in so many ways. It's not something bad, it's actually quite good. And being average or being normal is part of our individuality, which sounds strange, almost like a contradiction, but it's just, it's part of who we are. And it makes sense, even just realistically, just thinking about it objectively, you can't be very good or exceptional at many things. There might be some things, but you're not going to be exceptional on many things. And so we have to accept that on almost all things, you're going to be average, or even obviously below average too. And so in this way, individual psychology, although when you hear individual, it can, and when I bring up self-reliance, it could bring up these thoughts of this very me against the world, and, you know, we don't need one another, but it's very much about relationships and our interdependence with one another. But it's also very humanistic too. So although it's seeing the whole individual, not individual as an independent and separate from everyone else and everything else, but that we are actually quite interdependent and do need one another, and it's through relationships that we live life and go forward in our life. So that was quite interesting, the sense that being normal is actually okay and good, and we want to accept our own normalness. We don't need to think the way I'm going to be loved is if I'm always exceptional and standing out. And we can think of this love thirst that we see and we all can experience, or we might experience in different ways, of making sure we're seen and constantly needing that approval. But then this gets to this next concept, that instead of seeking approval, one has to approve oneself with one's own mind. And I thought that was really a powerful notion too. One that might seem intuitive, of course, yes, we shouldn't be seeking other people's approval. But it was discussed in at length, and I thought it was really well done the way it was expressed, of how important this is, that we recognize and value ourselves within ourselves. And that takes time to get to that place, but it is a very powerful one, going back to this courage to be disliked. If we have that, we're not acting out of fear of rejection or fear of the disapproval of others. We will go forward how we believe is right to go forward. But it's if we are or haven't reached the state of having our own approval for ourselves, we will be forever seeking the approval of others. And I had this funny thought, and I had to reflect on myself, that I think I've internalized some of this sense of approval, but I know I'm not all the way there, because I was thinking about this concept and I was like, oh, that's so interesting. This, yes, having that, your approval of yourself, and it comes from within. And I was, in a way, you could say, almost daydreaming, thinking about it a bit more, internalizing the thought of what's that is like. And I'll admit it, to me, it's funny because how ironic it was, but then I had this thought of, imagine other people, if they knew how much you approved of yourself, or that you were so self-reliant in this way on your own opinion. So it's funny that even in that daydream, I was thinking of being self-reliant, of having my own approval coming from within myself, but quickly it had to be seen by others, or I went to this place of how impressed others might be if they saw that. And so I had to then laugh when I recognized that my mind quickly went there, and it just showed how natural it was. And so more for me to explore personally on that. But often we might have this recognition in ourselves that we do something, and sometimes you might even be doing it alone, and you might imagine, well, often you'll hear people, if they're attracted to someone or want someone's affection, they might imagine, oh, what if they saw me doing this, the thing that I'm doing now, or how good I look now, or I'm working out, and if they saw that, or I'm reading, and I'm being nice, or all those things. We're fixated on that. If we can see how attached we are and how much we're doing things for the approval of others, not internally because we think it's the right thing. It also reminds me of people that very vocally express how much they don't care what people think about them, which is in a way a contradiction, because usually the way they're saying it and the fact that they're volunteering that information shows that they're saying, I don't care what people think, because they know that that's going to sound good to people, and so people are going to approve of that. So you say, oh, I don't care what anyone thinks about me, I do what I want to do. And so if you're saying that so outrightly and volunteering it without it being in some kind of context that makes sense for you to share that, it's very clear that you're saying that because you know that other people will be impressed by this, that you want their approval. So you're making sure that it's known that this is how you feel. So I thought that was a funny thought I had myself, but a reminder of how often we think that we're doing things just for ourselves, but if we dig a little bit deeper, we might see that the approval of others is a big part of what we're going through. So I think this is a very powerful concept, that instead of seeking approval, one has to approve oneself. We need to internalize that. And once we have that, it'll be a lot easier for us to function from what we think is right, rather than making sure others think we're good and right. There's also a lot of talk about love. And so this theme of that's what is going to make us ultimately happy. And there was this nice description of love, that rather than the self-interested seeking of my happiness or the other interested wishing for your happiness, love is the building of a happiness of an inseparable us, that it shifts our perspective and our focus from just making sure I'm happy, or in certain relationships, let's say a parent-child relationship where we have to make sure the other person is happy, to this us. And through that, we actually become happy. And through that, we live a good life. So love is a very central component of what's discussed in this book. It's in a way teased early on that love is going to be a big part of the discussion. And then it comes up very big at the end of the book, this concept of what love is and what it looks like, and trying to create this us and how important that is. And it was expressed very beautifully in the book. And also he talks about Eric Fromm, comes up a few times in the book, but especially in this part on love, and specifically the book, which is I think still my favorite book, The Art of Loving by Eric Fromm, is discussed, that often we're waiting to be loved, or think that the whole challenge about love is to find the right object to love, and especially to love us. And a lot of what we hear from people, or books or advice people are looking for, is how do I get someone to love me, or how do I find the right person that's going to love me and make me happy, that through their love I'm going to feel happy. And often we can see that this comes from a desire for this loved one, this new love, to love us, of course, as a romantic partner, but the way they do it is like a parent. It's unconditional. All I need to love myself is for someone to come into my life and to just love everything about me, the good, the bad, the ugly. They don't even see anything bad in me or anything ugly in me. They accept any of it. And no matter what I do, they still love me and will continue to love me. But that's not a mature love or what a real relationship is like. Yes, you create a strong bond over time, that it doesn't mean you do something wrong and the person's going to walk away. There's a huge level of commitment there and space for both people to make mistakes and for things to happen. But it's not unconditional in the sense that you can be as terrible as you want and the person doesn't go away. That's what a parent will do with a child, but it's not what a mature love looks like. And so we can see that what most people are looking for is unfortunately a result of what they didn't already get, and now in a adult relationship, they still think that's what they're supposed to look for. I have to find that person to love me and to make me feel good, and then I'm going to be happy. But actually, he talks about the courage to love also. It comes up in this book, in that you love without expectation or without knowing the result. And I think that's a really powerful stance, that when we enter relationships, when we enter so many things in life, we have to accept that it can go bad, that there's no guarantee that we will get a result we like, or that we will be happy with what happens, that we have to be ready to accept the pains that might come along with this. In love, you can get hurt. You're exposing yourself for some of the deepest types of pain and suffering, hurt that we can have in the relational sense. And so you have to risk that, but you have to choose to love and have that belief in it, and then you see what the other person will do. There was another part there where I didn't quite agree. The way it was expressed was almost like any two people can love each other and be together. The youth was flabbergasted by some of these points that the philosopher was making. I get what the point was, I think, was to say, definitely I agree with this part, that there isn't a soulmate or this destined person that we need to find. I think it goes back to this fantasy of the unconditional love, and it's so perfect that it can never go wrong, and they'll always love us and make us feel amazing. That I totally don't think is true. But the notion that then any two people can be together, I don't agree with either. It's much more complicated than that. And so you do your due diligence as far as understanding yourself first, but then also trying to understand your partner, and then seeing the type of relationship you have together. And then you do choose to love each other and recognize that it's not going to be perfect. It's going to be hard. Also, this notion that people sometimes have, like, well, what if there's someone better out there for me? And this idea that, well, there might be someone more perfect or better for me. And the way I think of that is, like, there almost definitely is someone in all the world that might be a better match in some way. But really, at the end of the day, you choose the person who you love and you're with, and you create a beautiful relationship with them. When I think of soulmates, I actually don't think there are soulmates, like a person destined for you. I don't believe in that at all. I do believe that you become soulmates. So because of the relationship you build and the love you build. So it's not a soulmate, it's something that was predestined, that then, okay, you know, God chose this person for you and these two people are soulmates and they come together and they have this beautiful love. Don't agree with that at all, or twin flames and those types of concepts. But I do believe that when you are together, and if you devote yourself together, described in this book as this us feeling, and you love each other and you continue to love each other and build that loving bond, you become soulmates. I don't mean that in some kind of supernatural way, but you create such a deep love and deep connection that now you're bonded. So it's an after the fact thing. It's not a before you are even born or before you know each other. It's predestined. It's something you create together. The happily ever after is not something predestined. The happily ever after is something you build one day at a time as partners in that relationship. And in the book, they talk about that too. Even he mentions, the philosopher says, we think about Cinderella, and then we think the story ends with happily ever after, but that's when the real story begins, not just the infatuation or the excitement and the passion of meeting each other. Now, how do they build a relationship together? And even talks about a big challenge of life is those nothing days. It's not in these huge big moments, and it's in the day to day. And I really agreed with that as well. Also, that another last notion that I'll wrap up the discussion in the book is that self-reliance is breaking away from self-centeredness. So self-reliance is breaking away from self-centeredness. So in childhood, when we're infants, it's talked about in this like golden era, this golden time when you're a baby, a child, especially when you're an infant, and all your needs are met by your parents, and whatever it is you need or want, it's just attended to and taken care of. And that obviously sounds quite nice. It is nice to think about that. However, that is not what brings us to a mature sense of being that we all strive for as we enter adulthood. That when we become self-reliant, or to become self-reliant, we have to break away from the self-centeredness that it's all about me and me getting my needs and my wants met all the time, exactly what I wanted. You have to break away from that. And I really valued this because it's something I recognize. I think it's a very much a current generation. We're moving more and more towards this. Also, I see it very American. It could be because I see America more, obviously, living here my whole life. But this notion that if I want something, I should have it. I want this, and I didn't get it, so now I'm mad. And if I'm mad, I could do something about it. Even, I think it's a type of theme we see with some school shootings or mass shootings, where it's a sense of, well, I wanted to have a girlfriend or a partner, or life has been not fair to me, so I'm going to go take it out on people, even if they're innocent people, or somehow they're some group of people, and I'm going to make that this enemy for me. And I think it does come from this notion that, well, I wanted something and I didn't get it, so isn't that wrong? I wanted it. Well, wanting it doesn't mean anything. You want it, and that's something you can care about, and might even try to make it a reality. But if you don't get what you want, that doesn't mean you have the right to be mad or take that out on anyone else. And even you shouldn't always get everything you want. I think this is also something we see more and more, this idea that, well, you should have everything you want always. And even that's what a lot of self-help and pop psychology types of, personalities, books, all those things promote, is this idea that I'm going to help you get everything you want all the time. And first of all, no one can do that. That's not possible. And I don't even think it's a healthy thing to strive towards. Recognizing that life is difficult, life is hard. Sometimes you shouldn't get what you want. Sometimes even you'll learn that the thing you wanted isn't even good for you in the long run, especially, or even some short run. But you find out maybe I shouldn't have had everything I wanted, even for the betterment of myself. But really getting away from this idea that because I want it, I should have it. I think it's a very dangerous one that I see becoming more and more common, to have everything you want. I don't think that's realistic or healthy. And so I really did like this notion that self-reliance is breaking away from self-centeredness, that I get what I want, everything gets, I get all my needs taken care of. That's not even healthy or realistic at all. So I'll conclude there on the book. Really, really enjoyed it, as it did last time, made me want to go study a bit more some of the concepts that came up in the book. Easy to read because of that conversational style. The whole book is essentially this conversation, a fictional one between a philosopher and a youth. At times, it's a little bit exaggerated, the responses, I thought, but nonetheless, it makes it an easy flowing read and shares the concepts in a different way rather than just presenting them in a standard format, in a conversational format, made it more enjoyable to read. So I highly recommend both of the books. Again, the previous one was The Courage to be Disliked. This one is The Courage to be Happy by Ichiro Kishimi and Fumitaki Koga. Let's go into our last commercial break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. To conclude the show, I wanted to talk about a realization or experience I had just a few days ago that really struck me, related to change and the experience of change, which is something we generally associate with anxiety or something negative. We don't want things to change. We don't want things to end. And there's reasons for that that do make sense. Of course, things like death and relationships ending can be very painful, and so we don't want that. But in general, we also avoid change most of the time. when we talk about a comfort zone, I alluded to it earlier in discussion of the book, we might not be happy. And this is something that so often happens in therapy when I bring up, let's say, something you're going through, seems like you're comfortable there, that might be your comfort zone. People say, well, no, it can't be my comfort zone because it hurts. I hate this, or it really feels bad. And that's just actually evidence of how powerful the comfort zone is that even though it might feel really, really bad and hurt so much, we might choose to stay there because we prefer that pain versus the unknown of putting ourselves out there or making some kind of change. We almost choose a more depressed down feeling than the anxiety of facing the unknown. So we choose the devil we know rather than the devil we don't know. And actually, we don't even know if it is a devil. It might be something quite good, might be an angel, might be something better than what we're experiencing. And so we avoid change often. And so what I experienced, though, and I've been thinking about it more, I think it also relates to just with the passage of time, getting older and recognizing how lucky we are to experience life, experience things, to have different experiences, to go through life with others and all the beauty that comes with that, was that how lucky we are also are to experience change. And in a way, the way I'll say it is that, well, when things are bad, we're lucky that they're going to get better. But just the recognition and realization, there's no guarantee that, for example, when we're in a bad mood, that mood won't last forever and change will come. Or actually, the way I experienced it was someone else was in a bad mood and I realized, okay, that was sad and didn't feel good, but realizing that their mood won't be the same forever. And the fact that I knew that change would come, that change would be part of life as it always is, it was a blessing. And I felt blessed that knowing that change was there. It also actually can help, especially with a situation like that. If someone else is in a bad mood, we often so quickly want to make things better and change that things that, okay, I need to cheer them up or convince them that what they're sad about is nothing to be sad about, or do something, distract them, reward them, whatever it is, that we actually do things that aren't helpful for the person, which is to allow them the space to go through what they are going through and to allow it to heal or change as it does itself. But with the recognition that change is part of life and that no matter how we feel, even if it's good, it won't last forever. That is part of the change. But also, if we're feeling bad or someone else is feeling bad, give them the space. We don't need to do anything to get them out of it. But it's a blessing to know that change also comes as part of life, to have those type of experiences. So it is interesting because I think, like many things, there's a paradox that we will be afraid of change. It doesn't mean just me saying this or having some of these realizations or experiences that I will welcome all change, embrace change, or even create change all the time. I still, I'm sure, will fear it in a variety of ways and continue to do that. But it can be good to have that perspective, to remember that. And even just this sense of the way we experience life, of each day being something separate, you know. I sometimes think of the calendar, and we're approaching the Persian New Year, and it brings with it so much hope and excitement of course, we celebrate and memories come up of years past, but also this excitement of a new year that we think it can be different. I do think we sometimes take this to idealized places, and I generally don't like when people say new year, new me, because one, it's not that you're going to totally change into someone very different, and two, you don't need to. Who you already are is good. We don't need a new you. We want you to be you. You might make some adjustments, changes in your life that could be positive or good. That could be good, but it's not this, we need to totally revolutionize who you are and you're going to become someone else. You can stay at some level you. We need you to be that. We want that. But this, the sense of new beginnings, but we need to have change to have new beginnings, to have a new day. I even think about the calendar sometimes of how it's a very depressing thought for me if we didn't have days of the week and days and months and the year changing. Imagine if it was just we counted the days, even that we can even count the minutes. But let's say we counted the days. So today would be day 157,643, and then tomorrow would be 644. And it was just this continuous string of days. It would feel like we would lose some sense of grounding in the world. I do think actually the calendar, it's kind of like a physical place, even though We have physical calendars. Now you might even have a digital one, but visually there's something there where you feel like you're somewhere. You know, spring feels like you're somewhere. We're back at spring. It feels like you're somewhere, or summer, or whatever it might be. And even that's why birthdays or anniversaries can be something. And it's the way we keep track of time because, you know, even for example, if there's a leap year, the amount of time between an anniversary will be one day different than the year before, but it still feels like we're back somewhere because of the calendar and the way we feel like it's almost like we're walking through the calendar as we go. But the fact that it comes back has a nice feeling, that familiarity. Interesting now that I'm saying it, maybe there's some paradox there with the change because something about it being the same feels good. And so I guess that makes sense. It's not that change is the only good thing and it should be constant change. We do need some constancy, some consistency, some things that are familiar as well. I'm just sharing that to not be as afraid of it or even also recognize the blessing that is change. But it's interesting how much the calendar feels like a place that we're somewhere. And we like that at some level. I think it does give us some grounding that we have that rather than not having that. So as we approach the new year, there is this feeling that comes up with so many different things related to that. But yeah, just coming back to this notion of change is sometimes it's tough. We see things change what we think is negatively as you age, for example, seeing your body change or seeing more wrinkles or white hair. If you know me, you know I have lots of white hair and I started pretty young with that. So I've seen that change, but seeing changes in your body or even things you could do that you can't do or can't do as well, it could be tough to accept that, acknowledge that, and many people resist that and fight that. I live in Los Angeles, which is a city known for people trying to make it seem like they're not aging at all and doing all sorts of things to prevent any signs of that showing. But I think it can be good to embrace that more, this sense of how we even age and part of the change that represents or is part of and what else changes. You might lose something and not to have some just optimistic view, well, that if you lose something, you must gain something back in some other way. You might not, but you do gain things as you get older, becoming wiser, becoming aware of certain things in a way. The crystallized intelligence increases, even if your fluid intelligence might start to get worse, I think, somewhere around your 20s. So there is value in who you are and what you are as you're getting older. But I do think it's important to recognize, as scary as change can be, that it's also a blessing that we get to experience different things, new things, that when things are bad, they won't forever stay that way either. And even when they're good, we get to experience something different. So change is a blessing, even if it scares us most of the time. That brings us to the end of tonight's show. A big thank you to Ghazaleh here in the studio. You've been listening to In Session with Dr. Farid Olakwi, Zan Zendegi Azadi.